Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. Established in 1608, the French Empire in North America proved itself to be one of the wealthiest superpowers on Earth. And though it stretched a distance from that of Paris to Moscow, this forgotten giant is all but lost to history. On today's episode, we're discussing New France. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. In Season 1 of this series, we're discussing the colonial frontier of North America, the peoples and ideas that altered its past, and the places and events that changed its future. As always, history is best when it's shared, and you can find me on Twitter, at Brady Kreitzer, on my author's website, BradyKreitzer.com, and of course, your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. Today we feature the forgotten legacy of New France, the great Goliath of North America, who, just as the English at the same time, invested a massive fortune in making sure that the future of the continent was its own. When we discuss this empire, we have to first understand why, for a lot of us, this may be the first time we ever consider it. I often pose this question to my students. And the question is, when we talk about the origins of colonial America, say the class is U.S. History 101, why do we minimize the colonial presence of a group like the French, or the Dutch, or the Spanish, or even the natives, while highlighting so much the ideas, the advances, the progressions, and the victories of the English? At first glance, the answer is not readily apparent. But of course, we get into a larger discussion of why we talk about anything in that class, while as historians, leaving other things out. And it gets to the idea of relevance. As a historian, one of the first things you have to deal with is the notion that you cannot include everything. And part of your historical training is being able to decipher what to leave in and what to leave out. Well, in the long history of colonial America, unfortunately, New France is often the victim of that style of thinking. We focus on the English in the American world because it's their imperial traditions that lead to our culture today. And unfortunately, New France, whose contributions are equally present, we often leave out how they attributed and altered North American society themselves. So we're going to discuss New France today because it was an enormous colonial experience. Very profound, very wealthy, and almost catastrophic for the people who lived there when it ultimately collapsed in 1763. Now, as we talk about New France, we are going to speak in generalities about empire, because it's through that lens that we'll see a much better version of New France itself, and we'll often compare them to the English colonial world as well. But let's talk for a second about why France is doing what it is. Empire in a broad, sweeping sense. Empire does a lot of things. But at its very core, its major driving push factor, empires have to grow. Remember, empires always do their best when they're competing. Competition is the driving force of empire, and North America is a highly competitive world. When we move into the 18th century, we'll see it's that competition between the English and the French, which is the driving factor of social change on the continent. But let's go early on. Let's go to the 16th century. We're going to go to the post 1492 world. And we're going to see how Europe is changing, because those changes will alter its direction and course forever. We all know the rhyme, we all know the poem. In 1492, Columbus sails the ocean blue. We get that. But when you factor in that he's an Italian sailing for Spain, it becomes a much more nuanced and difficult subject. But we'll break it down in the easiest way possible. Spain is truly the first European power to gain a foothold in the Western Hemisphere. And because they're the only game in town, the benefits that they reap from it are incredible. Now, if empires have to grow by their very existence, what is their chief mechanism of growth? We all know it. It's the colonial system. A colony. It's that simple. As you establish a colony, you allow your worldview to take hold in a place where it never existed before. And the rest is history. But what is a colony? Why is it valuable to us? Well, what we can say is, in the simplest way, a colony is only successful if it does one thing, and that one thing is make money. Think of a colony as a business investment. You put your own money into it, you move your own wealth into the project, and like all good investments, it should give you a return greater than your initial investment. Now, for empires, what's the investment? It's blood and it's treasure. When you establish a colony, you have to reinforce it, you have to protect it, you have to maintain it. All of these things require imperial funds being spent. That's the idea we're going at, a business venture. And for the Spanish, their initial investment in the New World will be an incredibly profitable one. By the year 1700, they'll have over 200 cities and towns in the Caribbean, Central America, and South America. And fortunately for them, the New World equates to almost endless amounts of wealth. Because they're not exporting some unique raw material. It's not tobacco. It's not opium. It's not some unique geographic cash crop. They're literally exporting gold and silver. It's an incredible idea. But their imperial economy will increase by 25%. Just from what they're pulling out of the ground. Gold and silver itself. Mineral wealth. So the Spanish, in some ways, spoil the game for everyone else in Europe. They're the first people to move into the New World, and the success they have is almost unthinkable. Now, if you're the kingdoms of England and the kingdoms of France, and you see Spain not only exploring the New World, but becoming the dominant superpower in Europe, every day that you don't invest in a colonial system in the Western Hemisphere is another day you fall behind them in terms of power and wealth. So the French, as well as the English, won't be far behind. Now, we typically know the English story a lot better when it comes to colonization. The lost colony of Roanoke, Jamestown founded in 1607, and the wonderful cash crop of tobacco being discovered shortly thereafter. Tobacco, a raw material occurring naturally in North America, puts Jamestown on the map and puts England in business. But what about the French? Because again, Europe is a world of eternal competition, and North America will be as well. Well, the French story is much more interesting, and as it turns out, very telling when it comes to perceptions and expectations of empire. New France is a worthwhile study. And I'll front-load it with this. We talk about imperial competition. We think about the success of the English. By the time the English reach the Appalachian Mountains, the Empire of New France, their great North American rival, has already touched the Rocky Mountains. That statement alone should get the gears turning and begin to bring questions into your mind. Remember, the great historical discoveries always ask more questions than they answer. So let's look at the early experience of New France in the New World, because it's a very, very revealing one. When we talk about the 16th century, you're really talking about one figure in the history of the French world, and that is Jacques Cartier. Now, Cartier has a dream, and his dream, an impossible one, is not an unusual one for the time period. He dreams of not only finding material wealth in the New World, but more importantly, he still has himself in a 16th century mindset. And in the 16th century mind, it's a very Pacific world. Wealth is what you pull out of Asia, the markets of China, and the markets of India. And because of that, the journey westward out of the Mediterranean Sea, southward around the southern tip of Africa, and eastward into those rich Asian markets dominates his thinking. So whenever he goes to the New World, his ambition is not indifferent than Columbus. Is there a way to find a faster journey to China? Because it's a grueling one based on the system I've just described. We call it the Northwest Passage. So Jacques Cartier will begin his exploration of North America in the name of New France, thinking just that. What can I find, and how soon can I find it? He will not have success early on. And the reason is not because he's not doing his job. He's exploring greatly. He's moving into the interior of North America, through the St. Lawrence River. He's going places where Europeans have, for all intents and purposes, never trod before. But the problem he's having is that he's not judging himself in a modern way. He's thinking in a Pacific world, or perhaps in a Spanish world. Remember we said the Empire of Spain kind of ruined empire early on for the other European powers by literally pulling coinage, gold and silver, out of the ground? Well, when Cartier is moving through Canada, he's thinking, I must find gold and silver, I must find diamonds and jewels, I must find a faster way to China. You're not going to find any of those things in Canada. And Cartier will believe, largely, that he is a failure for that reason. His dream just won't be realized. And this is his first mistake, because it doesn't necessarily mean that because Canada doesn't have the mineral wealth you're looking for, that there isn't a fortune to be made. It just means you have to look for your fortune elsewhere, and it is there. And when France realizes it, they will become a serious economic trading contender in the larger drama that is Europe of the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. Cartier will say, because of his perceptions, is a failure. And France will begin to turn away from Canada as far as exploration and, of course, the investment of royal treasure. Money makes the world go around today. It did then as well. But the dream of a French empire in North America only temporarily dies. It doesn't go away completely. It's just pushed aside. That is until 1608. In 1608, a man named Samuel de Champlain comes onto the scene. And because of increases in technology, and because of, more importantly, a change in perception, a change in expectation, an evolution in ideas, he is able to establish the first permanent settlement in North America for France. Again, this occurs roughly at the place we know today as Quebec. But it's the very small beginning of a very big thing. Because what Samuel de Champlain begins to realize is that gold and silver isn't the only way to attain wealth and power in North America. You just have to look at the situation differently. There's a quote I always go to, and I'll paraphrase it, but it's Albert Einstein. And Einstein says this, knowledge is limited, creativity is endless. And creativity is we as a species, as human beings, creativity is our best weapon. Samuel de Champlain has that weapon. He looks at the vastness of North America. He looks at everything that isn't gold and silver, everything, incidentally, you really can't find in Europe anymore. Europe's been habitated by people for thousands of years. Rich natural resources, like timber, like animal fur, all of these things are available in almost endless quantities in North America, and very rare and very scarce in Europe. So it's that change in perception, that realization that there's a lot of potential wealth in the New World. And only when that wealth is realized can the colony truly be successful. When Samuel de Champlain arrives, New France has its first start in the New World. And they're far behind. It's 1608. They're keeping right up with the English, but they're almost a century behind Spain. The notion of empire is a huge idea, and it's a complicated one. But it's a massive undertaking that is absolutely essential to staying relevant and competitive in the modern 17th century world. The rewards gained far outweigh the hardships suffered. And Samuel de Champlain, early on, is one of the first people to not only realize that, but feel the magnitude of empire in his own world. And I think Champlain is a figure worth looking into to understand the larger history of New France a little better. Samuel de Champlain is not a nobleman. He doesn't come from a very wealthy upper class in France. He comes from a family of mariners. He comes from a family of sailors. So it would be on him, in the earliest French experience in the New World, to be one of the first people to explore some of the regions yet untouched by Europeans. He, along with a few others, are some of the first individuals to move into the heart of North America. And again, it's an interesting idea, because when he's doing that, he's not simply leaving his own imperial comfort zone, but he's leaving his own economic comfort zone as well. Whenever the French consider North America, they think of how to make money there. Again, we've discussed this. Gold is on their minds. But even after that, there is very quick realization that big money is to be made in the natural resources of the continent. The earliest explorations and the earliest attempts to harvest these resources are fishing rights. Canada has an enormous amount of fish that could be fished in the 17th century. And Samuel de Champlain, no surprise, along with many others, are trolling the coast along the Atlantic Ocean of North America, exploiting these fisheries. It's the earliest and easiest and most accessible natural raw material that can be taken from North America. But Champlain will move inland down the St. Lawrence River, and he will establish the city of Quebec in 1608. And again, this is the beginning in a lot of ways of New France. Cartier's world, his Northwest Passage, his gold and silver mines, those are dreams of the past. But Champlain, whether he realizes it or not, is building an entirely new future for the empire of New France. So this is a good point for us to talk about how empires grow. Because it has to be clear as we begin, there has never been an official decree, an official document written in Versailles or Paris or London that has ever expanded empire in the way that the average person just living their lives ever could. I mean, think of that idea. Empire is this enormous extension of government. In many ways, it is the pinnacle of government overreach or outreach, whatever you want to think. And yet, empire does not spread by governments making conscious decisions to expand. They spread by the average populace doing what they do at home in a new environment altogether. And Champlain has a big part of this, because he understands that empire is about spreading the French way of life, not necessarily just planting flags everywhere. So Champlain will do two things early on that set the tone for the French presence in North America for the next two centuries. And those two things are this. Number one, he wants to expand France's imperial frontiers. And the other is that he wants to find a stable and ready French ally that can be drawn on for not only trading purposes, but also defense. So let's first look at how he expands the frontiers of empire. Champlain has an idea that the native peoples of North America are diverse and complex and have their own social hierarchy of their own. He's correct. And he also understands that not only learning the ways of those people, but allowing those people to learn the ways of France all play into a larger stratagem of imperial success. And the way Champlain really puts this in motion is effectively by using the resources he has, and that's manpower. Think of this. In 1630, there were about 150 French settlers in Canada. By 1640, you're looking at 300. Now, this is not an enormous quantity of people, but it is enough people based on their specialized skills, their ability to survive in the wilderness, that will be very beneficial for Champlain's overall strategy. He creates effectively a commission, a way of taking these young, adventurous, ambitious French traders and sending them into the New World. The way we often view early trading in Canada is difficult to determine in many cases because it takes on a lot of different looks over a very long period of time. But the best example we have at French borders being expanded by the works of average people are by dealing with a group of people that the French called the coureurs du bois, or more simply in English, the runners of the forest. Now, the coureurs du bois, as a group, will do and play a very important role in spreading the fortunes of New France, because what they are effectively are independent traders. They are young men who come to the continent with the express goal of making money. And the way that they'll do that is by both interacting with the native peoples, giving to them and taking from them. They're engaging in the fur trade in the earliest experiences in North America, and fur, as it is, will become the primary staple raw material of New France in the 17th and 18th century. But these runners of the forest, these independent associators, these private traders, will make their own fortunes very well. And early on, there's very little government intervention in this. The idea in Champlain's mind is simple. Send these people into the forest, let them trade, let them make money, let them not only learn the ways of the natives, but teach the natives the ways of the French. And in the end, the empire will expand as a result in both experience and fortune. This system is not indifferent to something we've taken to in the modern age, in that there will be tax breaks or tax exemptions for startup small businesses. The reason being is that it gives these small businesses a chance to be successful without the early burden of government intervention, them weighing them down or altering their decision-making process. But the coureurs du bois, the runners of the woods, wouldn't have this freedom forever. Because, as we've established earlier, colonies can only be viewed as successful if they serve their purpose in uplifting the empire itself, serving the empire by raising money. So yes, New France is a place in the early part of the 17th century of great freedom, great opportunity for a young person to be successful. But in the end, the empire always has to get the lion's share of the benefit. And in 1627, we see the policies of New France change forever. Because to this point, France itself in Europe, in the Palace of Versailles, has been very far removed by how Champlain negotiates and administrates over the colony. The Coureurs du Bois are a good example of that. But in 1627, Cardinal Richelieu, back in France, will make the determination that New France is clearly a viable business opportunity and an excellent resource for France in the end. In that year, again, about two decades after Champlain founds Quebec, as it were, Richelieu will create what he calls the Company of 100 Associates. And what this is a group of business investors getting together, 100 of them, as you can imagine, in France, all pooling together their resources, 3,000 livres apiece, for an initial business offering, an initial investment in New France to give the empire a more firm grasp on the occurrences and the wealth of the continent. Now, Richelieu is very clear on why he's doing this. First and foremost, it's always about the money. It's always about collecting the revenue by establishing a clear and controllable closed economic market in the New World. But he also has a more public reason for doing this. And this gets to the heart of spreading French worldview. That is, of course, the Catholic Church. Cardinal Richelieu is a man that many consider to be Europe's first modern example of a prime minister. But he's also a servant of the church, so he has those dual obligations. And in this world, in the 17th century, patriotism and religious fervor often go hand in hand. What do I mean? Well, we all know the story of Henry VIII separating from the church in Rome, creating the Church of England, putting himself at the top. At that moment, all people who live in the English world have to be members of the Church of England. It's that simple. So patriotism and religious obligation are suddenly one and the same. Nationalism and faith are intertwined forever. It's a difficult world. But when you're trying to expand the Empire of France, and of course that being the French worldview, Catholicism is a major part of this. So whenever the Company of 100 Associates begins, whenever it begins to promote this new agenda in the new world, the Coureurs du Bois have to instantly stop what they're doing. Not in the way that they do it, but in how it's administered. They need papers, effectively, and the empire creates a very modern and very structured way of keeping tabs on them. It's very sort of mind-blowing for us moderns to view just how invested and how entrenched these notions of government overreach really could be, but they were there well in place in the 17th century in New France. But one other twinge of how Richelieu's Company of 100 Associates changes the New World comes in its obligations to patriotism and Catholicism. And that emerges in the idea that one of the stipulations in this new attempt to rein in the colony, more under the control of France itself, is that if you are going to live in the New World, you had to be Roman Catholic. Think of that idea. If you're going to live there, you had to be Roman Catholic. So put yourself in the position of one of these independent traders. To this point, for 20 years of your life, you've been making a nice living. You've been interacting with the native peoples, learning their languages, learning their ways, benefiting from their trade. And now suddenly, the Empire of France takes an interest. Just when you reach your economic peak, when you're making the money that seems to be what you desired from the New World in the first place, here comes the government. Here comes that old power that for so many years has been absent in so many ways in the New World. Not only do you have to have an administered and licensed documentation to practice what you've been doing for years, but you also have to potentially change your faith or else. So again, when religion and politics are intertwined, and in the 17th century, religion and patriotism are intertwined, you are faced with a difficult dilemma. How much of that dilemma is present? Well, it may involve you either changing your faith, changing your religious devotion, or leaving and abandoning that way of life. So little by little, we're seeing that New France, and this is really true of all colonies in the European world, is given a large amount of rope, a large amount of slack early on. It's not sure if the colonies will become economically viable, but once they do, and this is true in London as well as Versailles, once they become successful, they have to be reined in, because the initial investment was by the empire. And after they become viable, it's the colony's turn to serve the empire. Samuel de Champlain will effectively become the first governor of New France. He's never given that title, probably because he was not of noble blood. But in everything that he does, whether it be the Coureur du Bois system, or whether it be the implementation of Richelieu's new system, he is that new chief administrator on the continent. His time, as well as the time of virtual independence in the colony, however, is coming to an end. And this is when we really see Imperial New France hit its stride as far as the capability to create wealth and to be competitive on a world scale. So Champlain really ingrains himself early on as a major political leader on the continent. But it wasn't the first time this happened. Early on in Champlain's experiences, he makes decisions as early as 1609 that dramatically alter the course of the continent. Those, of course, are the second part to exploring and understanding his impact, his dealings with the native peoples. One of the things that Champlain really understood, and it's to his credit, is that even though from the European perspective, many of these native groups can be viewed as homogenous, can be viewed as similar, there was actually a very nuanced and very difficult strategic and cultural hierarchy within Native America itself, with long-lasting alliances and long-lasting feuds. Champlain wanted to position France, and of course his own settlement, in a place that would benefit him between these two warring factions of the native world. We'll talk about that now. The world that Champlain injected himself into was one of almost constant warfare between two major powers. On one side, you had the enormously influential Iroquois Confederacy. They were expanding their fortunes northward toward what is today Canada, the St. Lawrence River, but already in place in that same area on the northern coast of the river were a collection of Algonquian-speaking native peoples who were in constant struggles with these Iroquois. And when Champlain looked at the picture, he looked at which areas had the most fruitful and potentially profitable hunting grounds, because it was fur that was going to determine the future of France. Think about this. One beaver pelt could be purchased in the New World for about 3 French livres. That same beaver pelt could be sold in Europe for almost 200. Now, you don't have to know conversion rates to understand the importance of that. And Champlain will align himself with the Algonquian-speaking tribes in an effort to win their favor and, hopefully, more importantly, rights to hunt on their grounds. Champlain and his men would manifest themselves in this struggle openly, and it wouldn't take long. Within 2 months of aligning himself with the Algonquian peoples, Champlain finds himself on the field of battle with the Iroquois by 1609. As the story goes, there were about 200 warriors on each side of the battle, and Champlain, with one shot of his arquebus, took out two Iroquois chiefs. One of his men would take out a third. And upon seeing this horrible new weapon, the Iroquois fled from the field of battle, and the Algonquians and the French solidified their friendship. Now, how much truth is to that story of those events that took place along Lake Champlain in today's upstate New York? It's very difficult to determine. But we do know that from that moment on, the Iroquois Confederacy viewed the Empire of New France as an enemy, with as much venom and as much spite as any traditional enemy they had in the native world themselves. So it's an interesting idea, but Champlain, before he will leave the continent, effectively, makes those two decisions, launching the Courrier du Bois into the wilderness and siding with the Algonquian peoples and therefore making a long-time Iroquois enemy, to succeeding in this new world and putting New France on top. So it's a powerful idea. But it gets back to something we've talked about earlier, because Champlain won't be around forever. We know that. So who will replace him? Well, as is generally the case in history, in these early social experiments, no one man can ever replace a figure as big as Samuel de Champlain. So the group that will move in and really replace him as the dominant power broker in the French world, interestingly enough, is the Catholic Church. We cannot stress with enough vigor how closely tied national patriotic pride and religious sectarian faith really are in the 18th century. It's immensely important. And the Jesuit missions of the Catholic Church will replace Champlain in that regard. They'll become the new trendsetters of empire in New France. They'll establish a new settlement they'll call Ville-Marie, down the St. Lawrence River from Quebec, that will become Montreal, and that will become the new hub of the fur trade in the New World for the Empire of France. It will also become, as it were, for about 50 years, a primary target for angry Iroquois warriors who seek revenge for that earlier French alliance with the Algonquians. But that's what you see. And again, it's those almost extraneous elements of empire. Not something decreed from Versailles, but just the average realities of people living their lives as they would in a different new world that really add to the strength and fervor of empire. That's how New France is constructed. But even in the way that the empire grows, we see that Britain and France have entirely different perceptions of empire. And that's something we really have to get across in this way. All too often, when we discuss the English Empire in North America and the French Empire in North America, we get so lost on the geography of the setting of the stories that we often don't stop to analyze it in the appropriate way. Remember early on in the program, I mentioned to you that by the time that the English colonies had reached the Appalachian Mountains, the Empire of New France had stretched almost to the Rockies. And that's a misleading statement. It's true, but it's misleading in the way that both empires view their colonies and colonial expansion in completely different ways. The English develop and build on what we call a clear and hold strategy. That is to say, most of their settlements begin on the coast of the Atlantic Ocean, and expand westward very slowly. And the idea, simply put, is this: for every square foot, for every square inch of land that the English clear of trees, they plant and settle. So what you have is a very slow-growing westward colonial system that ultimately is comfortable and confident in the fact that whatever land you've cleared is going to be yours on a permanent basis. So the English world grows very slowly, but very permanently. On the inverse, the vision of New France is almost entirely different. Theirs is an empire built not of land, but of waterways. The French believe, correctly, that North America is something like the human body. The heart of the body is the center of it, for New France. That would be Quebec, Ville-Marie, or Montreal along the St. Lawrence River. But the entire body is connected back to the heart through veins, and the veins of North America are the waterways. So the French put all of their efforts in expanding geographically as far as they possibly could, as quickly as they possibly could. And they traveled all through the Great Lakes, a land they called the Pays d'Arnaud, all the way to the base of the Rocky Mountains in some cases, all the way as far south as Louisiana. But as they were doing it, they weren't fortifying it. They weren't holding the land the way the English were. So they gained much more land, much more quickly, but they didn't hold it. Now, the mechanism of control they used was building forts. They'd build a series of tiny forts at all major river crossings, or two places where bodies of water came together. And they believed that was sufficient enough to dominate trade, which is what they were most interested in, and defend these waterways from their English rivals. But the problem is, it was a very precarious situation. Because if you could sever those arteries at critical places, every fort downriver, downstream, across the lake, would be sacrificed as well. Because they lost that vital connection back to the heart of New France, along the St. Lawrence River. So you had two entirely different perceptions of empire. And when we see these two imperial colonies collide, you're going to see the inherent advantage that the English will ultimately have in the long run, because they figure this system out. That yes, the French appear to be everywhere, but how permanent are they really? If you can sever that primary artery, that is the Mississippi River, that is the Niagara River from the Great Lakes, that is everything that connects it to the St. Lawrence, the entire empire will crumble as a result. So when we think of New France, we can often minimize it, because as we say, history is written all too often by the winners. But in this regard, the colonial legacy of New France is still very real in North America. It's very hard to feel around you in the United States today, but visit Canada, visit Montreal, visit Quebec. You can feel like at times you are in a European city, but it's not just that they live in a European custom. It's that it's foreign to us. It's alien to us. It's of French origins. While the United States of America, most of Canada, can tend to be built on these resounding English origins. It's a worthwhile study, and it's an important piece of the puzzle to unlocking what is colonial America in the 18th century. Thank you for joining us. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.